This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
The year is 1976.
And they're all going to laugh at your podcast. They're all going to laugh at your podcast. They're all going to laugh at your podcast.
The movie, Carrie.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I am Paul Scheer, joined as always by my co-host, the great Amy Nicholson. Amy,
bonjour.
I am so happy that you are highlighting some of your amazing reviews that you were writing recently. I've been checking out your Instagram account. Your review of Challengers was great, and it actually calls back to Call Me By Your Name. And, you know, if you're not reading Amy, just subscribe, get on board, get with her, get into it.
Aw, thank you. I read that one for the LA Times. I love writing for those people over there. I will say there was a line in the Challengers review that when I thought of it, it made me really laugh out loud, and I was very excited to write it down.
I love it, and I know what it is. So today we are talking about Carrie, a movie that you could argue redefined horror for generations.
Yes, yes. We are going to talk about a movie that to me, hits me like a potato peeler right to the heart. I mean, I feel like I have just been a Carrie girl my entire life. I've even been to a pancake breakfast where the pancakes were like a stack of pancakes with a Carrie statue in the middle of it covered in strawberry syrup. That's where Carrie is in my heart and in my stomach.
Well, I do want to talk about really the center of this movie, which is Sissy Spacek. I mean, she is absolutely unbelievable. And I don't know if this movie works without her, because she isn't just a great actress, but the way that she looks, I think, goes a very long way in creating this complexity of this movie.
I think that's really true. I think, like, when you can play a mental game of, like, would a non-Sissy Spacek person have carried this idea of being almost like an otherworldly person from another planet that we don't understand at all. You know, like, there's a mystery in Sissy Spacek. There's like a mystery and a vulnerability and a little bit of like a dignity and a little bit of anger that I think makes this Carrie so complicated and not just a, well, sad victim girl.
Totally agree. Well, Amy, I think that it's time to hoist our pig blood up to the ceiling. And if either one of us makes a mistake in pronouncing someone's name, we're going to get it. In other words, it's time to unspool. The year is 1976, and Stephen King's name is misspelled in the trailer for the very first movie based on his very first published novel, and it was spelled S-T-E-V-E-N, King. But, I mean, who's complaining? Because just a few years earlier, Stephen King was living a very different life, right? He was scrubbing blood and lobster butter stains off at an industrial laundromat. His wife, Tabitha, a brilliant writer herself, she was working at Dunkin' Donuts. They were just in their 20s with two kids, a double-wide trailer, and they might have stayed that way forever if Tabitha hadn't found a couple crumpled up pages of one of Stephen's abandoned short stories in the trash can. She took them out and said, hey, you should finish this one. It's about the high school girl.
That high school girl was named, of course, Carrie. And Stephen had thrown his pages about her away because he wasn't sure he liked her very much. Carrie was a social outcast who had telekinesis. That was a thing he had just actually read about in a magazine. And a few years back, Stephen had also worked a couple shifts as a high school janitor. He went into the women's locker room and he was totally caught off guard to see that in the girls' locker room, there were curtains on the shower stalls. The boys did not have that. And there's also this box on the wall that he thought was for paper towels until his buddy was like, nah, man, they're for tampons and pads. So this kind of stuck in his head. And from there, he had this idea of a scene, a girls' locker room where there are no curtains and a girl gets her period and she is publicly shamed. Tabitha said she could help out with any more questions he had about the lives of teenage girls if he would just get back to writing it. And once he was really concentrating on getting into this world, he remembered two bullied girls from his high school years. One was so poor that she wore the same clothes every day, literally every day, the entire school year. And the other girl was way, way, way under the thumb of her religious zealot mom. And both of those girls, by the way, had already died. Again, he's only 26, but both of those girls had died. It is a rough life to be a bullied girl.
Now, Carrie sold okay in hardcover, but in paperback, it was a huge hit. I mean, Stephen King made so much money just from the advance that he was able to upgrade his family from the trailer and write full time. But it was still a bit of a risk for Brian De Palma when he decided to turn it into a movie. I mean, it could have easily been a schlocky B flick, which would have sucked for De Palma because he would have been officially just written off, you know, as a loser failure among, you know, his best buddies like Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, and Martin Scorsese. So he had to make the best Carrie he could, which means casting the best actress to play Carrie, who turned out to be someone he barely thought of as an actress. It was his production designer's wife, Sissy Spacek, who, and we'll get into it, really had to fight for the role. He filled out the rest of the cast with Oscar nominee Piper Laurie as Carrie's mother, Margaret, and Nancy Allen, PJ Souls, and Amy Irving as Carrie's bullies, Chris, Norma, and Sue. Then there was also John Travolta and William Catt as Chris and Sue's boyfriends, Billy and Tommy. Now, Tommy is the guy with the big blonde hair who takes Carrie to the prom in her pale pink satin dress and gives her her first kiss. And finally, there's Betty Buckley as the gym teacher, Miss Collins, who tries her best to treat Carrie like a normal girl. But when that fails, the entire prom gets destroyed in a telekinetic hellfire.
Carrie was released on November 3rd, 1976, and was pretty much immediately recognized as being one of the key films that redefined horror. We've actually done eps on some of the other ones from this era, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist, and Halloween. People knew it was a big deal at the time. It is always so nice when that happens. Lately, it feels like it hasn't happened a lot in a lot of the films we've been covering. Sissy and Piper were even nominated for Oscars. Sissy for Best Actress, Piper for Supporting. And Sissy won Best Actress from the National Society of Film Critics. Shout out to my predecessors in that group. I will carry your banner and try to continue on highlighting those kind of performances. And Stephen King, of course, becomes so famous and so prolific that there have now been almost 90 movies based on his material, which is wild. So what was in the zeitgeist that November of 1976? Well, the number one song on the Billboard charts is a number about being really, really nice to a virgin on the very special night that she has decided that a guy with big blonde hair will be her first. It is Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night, and the video for it even has him lounging around with the girl he's singing about, this girl who has long, straight, blonde hair, and she's wearing a pale pink satin dress, and we never, ever, ever see her face. We know now that it's really his girlfriend at the time, the actress Britt Eklund, but you can watch the video today, and you can pretend that that girl is Carrie, and that if Rod Stewart does not treat her right, well, look out, dude, because it is not going to be all right. Ooh, baby, don't you hesitate.
I did not know that song was about fucking. I heard that so much as a kid. And wow.
what an innocent brain you have. That song is so much about fucking that it actually was banned from certain radio stations. They're wow. like, hold up, spread your wings and get let me enter. What the fuck?
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, it's, of course, incredibly clear. But, you know, there are songs that you just, you know, they're like earworms and you never really go deeper into it.
As a child, I walked around singing Warrant, She's My Cherry Pie all the time. No clue.
Now, I will say this. Very honestly, I've never seen this film, right? This is my first introduction to Carrie. And my first reaction to it is this movie hit me like a ton of bricks because all of a sudden I saw the Rosetta Stone of horror, right? I've seen things, references that I never knew. I'm like, oh, that's where that came from? Like, they're all going to laugh at you. They're all going to laugh at you. I've seen that a million times. I never knew that was a thing. I think I may have even put that in a sketch that I had. And I was like, oh, that's funny. I didn't understand what that was from.
Wow. Oh, that's so exciting. Seeing the world click into place. Is this what it's like being a parent, except you are my child?
I mean, in a way, I guess so. And I guess really what I saw was A24. Like, I saw A24 movies in this film. And obviously, it took a long time for A24 to come out from when this movie was released. But I was thinking about Ty West. I was thinking about the movies that he has been making and the style and tone. And it's a different tone for horror. But I will say, I'll be very bold in saying that it is all building to this end moment. And the fact that this movie is advertised with that end moment is really, it does it a disservice to a first-time viewer. Now, I get that, you know, many people have seen this movie, but to see her covered in blood, to see her on that stage, it really does, for me, hurt the whole experience of watching this movie because it just kind of leads up to that moment, and then that's the movie. And I've already seen it. I already felt like I had seen it. Like, I felt like there was nothing. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't surprised. I'm like, yeah. And it was very hard for me to separate myself from knowing the end.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that even the trailer of this time, like, I get on modern trailers for giving away too much, but the trailer of Carrie, even at the time, not only showed you the whole thing that was going to happen, but it also did it with, you know, the psycho Greek, Greek, Greek,
right.
Greek, that we hear in the movie.
The girl no one likes.
We're all sorry about this incident, Cassie.
It's Carrie!
And everyone makes fun of her.
Free Carrie!
The girl who lives in that creepy house.
Which, by the way, as an aside, you know, one of the things that continually astonishes me when you look back at moments of like our sort of recent cinematic past is realizing that those people were coexisting with the people of like the classics, and that Hitchcock was, of course, alive when Brian De Palma was paying so many homages to him, and that Hitchcock was mad about it. He was like, stop ripping me off, which I think is funny because now we're in an era where everybody's ripping off everything from the 80s and they're like, but it's an honorable homage. And the fact that the director was like, no, leave me alone. Sometimes I wonder if Steven Spielberg is like, stop doing like wide-eyed little children, man. That's my thing. But yeah, like, okay, I have to ask you this then. Having never seen Carrie, when you watched the movie, was it exactly the movie you had in your head? Or what were you picturing when you thought, what is Carrie about?
I thought it was about a girl who was picked on, who then, you know, has this emotional break that kills everybody that is at prom. Like, they make fun of her. I knew the plot without knowing the plot. It just really from that image and how it is in culture. I think what I was surprised by was that this movie reminded me less of a horror film and more of a movie that we did early on in the podcast called Brian's Song. It felt to me like an after-school special that just was a little dirtier. Like, and it was like an R-rated after-school special. I thought it looked like an after-school special. I thought it was acted like an after-school special. I felt like it just, I was not impressed by a lot of the choices here. I thought the acting was like so big and so goofy. And I thought that there were some things that were just gratuitous and and weird. And then all of a sudden, after I got over that, I started to be like, okay, I get what he's going for. The, you know, there are things here that I like. Sissy Spacek is amazing. And I think that she really is the glue. But every time it got off of her, it just felt so stereotypical. And I understand how De Palma was like, how do I make this into a movie? Because it really is just like picked on girl, gets attacked, gets her revenge. It's not really like a three-act structure at all. It feels very, yeah, it feels very small and linear.
It is linear, but what I also feel when I watch this movie is that it's a movie with kind of mysteries. Like learning that Stephen King really wanted to give up on this at the beginning because he never liked Carrie. He never really understood Carrie. And then when he came up with the character of Sue, the nicest of the bullied girls, the Amy Irving character, who's like,
yeah,
I insist that my boyfriend take Carrie to the prom, even if it means I'm not going to the prom. And I insist it, and I'm going to steamroll everybody about it. And I'm going to really just like make this happen to my boyfriend. Where, you know, she's like so bullying about it in ways that I admire, where the teacher is sitting her and her boyfriend down and she's like, what are you doing? Are you setting up Carrie? Is this a prank? What are you doing? And she turns to, the teacher turns to her boyfriend, to Tommy, and she's like, what's it going to be like walking into the room with Carrie? How are you going to feel about that? Are you really going to be able to do this? And Amy Irving answers for them and she's like, we're fine. We don't care how we look. You know, that character being so headstrong for reasons that aren't that clear, there's something in that. Stephen King felt like he never trusted Sue either completely. And there's a murk around that film, the pity and the confusion that I love sinking into because I don't know what to think about Sue. But not knowing what to think about Sue and not knowing how I feel about Carrie is the complication that I love. You know, that you can like feel bad for Carrie and dislike Carrie. That even the gym teacher who's trying to protect her is like, hey, I wanted to slap her, man. And I can't even explain why I wanted to slap her. I just did.
I think that idea that you have this character who, let's just be bold and say, is unlikable, right? She's a nerd. Is she worthy of the attacks that she's getting? Absolutely not. But I also don't think that she's somebody that you're like, oh, I really want to spend a lot of time with her. Makes this movie really interesting because it does ask you that question. Even if you don't like her, even if you think she's weird, is she worthy of this amount of ridicule? And I think that that probably is the most interesting thing about this movie. Where do you fall on that? And I think that, you know, William Catt is really wonderful in this. I like his performance a lot. I like Amy Irving a lot, too. I think the second act of the movie, you start to see some more of these characters in a way that's a little less stereotypical. Or because that beginning really was, I was just put off. I was expecting something so much more interesting, and there's so much boobs in the front of it that was like, oh, what am I? It just felt like,
I mean, it is a movie from the 70s/80s where there's going to be a certain amount of tits in the contract and a lot of soft core soaping of Carrie's body to very, very romantic shower music that then cuts off when you start seeing the blood. I don't want this to be like a male female thing because I believe that the world is so much more transcendent than that. But the specificity of a girl of getting your period in front of people, it to me, that opening scene is just, it hits something absolutely primal and terrifying in me. Like, just so scary. And then I'm looking at her face and she's so confused and she doesn't know why she is bleeding. I mean, having your period is such a crazy thing. You know, like when you're a little girl, they talk about it all the time. Like, it's going to happen and you're going to bleed and you take all your like sex ed classes and you're still just like, what? Why? How? And then it like the society just like plays into your fears all the time. Like I grew up in an era where I think all the teen magazines had like pictures of girls in white pants and white swimsuits. And they're like, but she's on her period and everything's fine. And it just makes you feel scared to go anywhere out in the world. Like all hell could break loose at any moment, you know? And then to have that play through this character who is terrified. Nobody's even given her the heads up and her pathetic little like, help me, help me. Oh, it just like to me that it like stabs me straight in the heart. But then I understand, like, this, I grew up girl. Like, I don't know if I don't have like the same fears of like getting a boner out of nowhere, right?
Well, look, you're introduced to Carrie in this way where you immediately know she's an outcast and she seems...
I mean, she's bad at volleyball. I am bad at volleyball. It's also real.
But there's something about the way that she looks. She looks a little like, and I want to, and this may be not the best word to use, but I'll use it, like simple, right? Like they looks like, oh, she's not like on this same plane as everybody else. Everybody else is in a very 80s kind of mold. And she just looks, you know, we're going to see how she's repressed. We're going to see where she's coming from. So now with that knowledge
that
I learned.
There's a quote like from like Pauline Kael that I think just like sums up exactly what you're describing right now, where it says that she looks like a fetus.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't know what her background is. So we are introduced to this scene. We're just seeing a lot of breasts in this opening scene. Like, and we're like, all right, what's going on here? Then we're in this, like, shower scene. And the shower scene, and this is maybe, again, I don't want to speak for you. You just said, you know, it's you relate to it because you're a woman. But it seems to me, like, the way that scene opens, it's a little too... exploitative in a way. Like she's just really rubbing. Like I don't buy that from this character. And it feels almost like, is she going to start masturbating in this shower? Or it's really bizarre, I think, the way that they do that scene.
I thought it was weird too. I actually read a quote from Sissy Spacek explaining why she played that scene that way and why it was filmed that way that then made it make sense to me, but I wouldn't have picked up on it before. She was like, I played that scene as though Carrie doesn't get to take hot showers at her house. And this is the most pleasure she gets in her entire day, is getting to take a warm shower. And I hadn't really put that together with the fact that when she's covered in blood, she has to get in a bathtub in her own home and scrub from a bathtub and try to get clean. But she was like, this is her only pleasure, is taking a hot shower.
Yeah, I love that idea. But again, as an audience member, we're walking into this and this is a lot, like we don't know anything yet, right? If we would have put the scene maybe just a beat later, you know, maybe started from her house and got to see a little bit of it, it might have resonated more. But instead, it feels to me like this kind of exploitative scene. And then when she does, you know, start bleeding, which I think you're right, this is a horrific moment. I think there is something in the way that you described the initial concept of it. Not having curtains and someone seeing you get your period and making fun of you. But what happens here is she gets her period and acts absolutely insane. I think the note that she was given was, pretend like you were hit by a Mack truck. So when you see her, now I understand she's repressed and she's so confused and she probably doesn't even know anything about anything.
Yeah, she's never been told that periods happen before. She doesn't understand. She thinks she's dying. She literally thinks she's dying.
And again, I like all of this, but I feel like it was a lot for me to get into. Like now looking back at it, I'm like, oh, that is interesting. Okay, sure. But it does everything in the world to push you away from this character because she's, you know, grabbing people like, you know, I'm like, what the hell? Like I am immediately put off by Carrie. And maybe that's what De Palma wants me to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because it's how everybody feels.
Yeah.
In that scene. It's how her teacher feels. The one who's like clinging to her. Like, you don't know what she wants. She's like screaming at you with bloody hands. You don't know that she doesn't know what this is. Because you're right. You don't know. They don't know. Nobody knows that she doesn't know what's happening. All they know is this freaky looking girl has blood on her hands and she's getting blood on my clothes. And it is so viscerally like repellent, right?
Absolutely. And I really think that this is a great idea for an opening scene. I get what's so interesting about it, right? And how this person would be mocked. And this really is the catalyst for the entire movie, right? She gets her period. The girls make fun of her. She then really doesn't do much, but the teacher pits her against the rest of the students in a way. Like it becomes this thing of now we need to get back at her, even though Carrie has done nothing wrong, but be a little bit more heightened than we already know.
You're right. Like Carrie doesn't know that then the gym teacher goes to the other girls who bullied her, makes them do, you know, squats to hilarious music.
One, two, bend up, one, two, one, two, one.
And then says, if they don't continue to do all the squats she wants them to do, she's not going to let them go to prom. And like Carrie has actually nothing to do with this. It's interesting, right? Because it's like a person who thinks they're sticking up for Carrie, trying to help Carrie, making a situation worse by then making all the girls get mad at her. Because that is like, it, like the other girls could have gone on with their day and just continued making fun of Carrie and life could have continued on in that same mold if the teacher hadn't gotten involved. And then had the scene where like Chris, you know, the worst of all of them, who is so terrifying and played by Nancy Allen, who's going to wind up marrying Brian De Palma after this and being in a really good movie with like him and John Travolta, that like Chris loses her mind and she's like, I'm not going to keep doing these squats. And then she gets yelled at and told she can't go to prom anymore. And then that's what makes Chris just absolutely lose it. And I want to listen to that scene where like Chris is told in front of everybody that she can't go to prom, because in a way it's like the closest she comes to feeling like Carrie. She's set apart from her group and nobody has her back.
She can't get away with this if we all stick together, Norma! Honey. Helen! Sue!
Shut up, Chris. Just shut up.
This isn't over. This isn't over by a long shot!
You're out of the prom, Hargensen!
But then the difference is like, Chris handles getting isolated and rejected and mocked by being like, well, I'll show you. I'm going to kill a pig and wreak complete havoc and destroy things. And Carrie just continues on until, well, I guess she also wreaks havoc and destroys everything.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm one of the hosts of Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast. Every week, we cover the ups and downs of the Oscar race, from Barbenheimer to the Golden Globes controversy, and much more. We also have weekly interviews with some of the year's biggest contenders, like Emma Stone, Paul Giamatti, and America Ferrera. Whether you're a Hollywood insider or just want to win your office's Oscar pool, listen to Little Gold Men, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now.
And overall, and you're right, like, I like this story. I like the story of, don't pick on the quiet one. You know, this is something that we go to in storytelling a lot. You know, like, not be afraid of the people who are meek, but you don't know what will happen, right? Like, you, like, it could be this, like, a powder keg. And obviously, this is an incredible powder keg. And there's so much going on here that is interesting. And I think that De Palma is trying to take essentially a short story and make it into a movie, you know, and that is, you know, I think he does a good job of blowing out the home life. Now it's heightened, it's big, it's crazy. And that's what I can't quite put my finger on. I mean, is that more stylistically what De Palma does? I don't feel familiar with him enough to be like, oh yeah, no, he's always pushing these.
He's a big guy. He's big. Yeah, he likes it big and dramatic.
And so
yeah.
I feel like maybe my taste is to the smaller details. And obviously they've remade Carrie a bunch too. There's Carrie 2, there's Carrie, you know, remakes, there's reboots. It's a story that we go back to, even the story of Carrie. But is there enough there?
I mean, I feel like this is one of those movies where to me, almost the less there is, the more room there is for me to come in and fill it up with my own experience. You know, like there's some films where they seem like you can relate to the basic idea of it so much that there's space. You know how like some novelists, when they write their characters, they don't describe what their characters look like too much. We were just even talking about right. The novelist the other day who does that because they want the reader. Oh, it's The Martian. Because they want the reader to be able to fill in how they picture the characters right. Looking and feeling. There are some movies where like I think they withhold so much that it leaves just tons of room for you to add your own interpretation. And to me, this is one of them. And I think it's so interesting to hear you talk about it as like – this is a film made as a warning not to pick on the bully. When, right. like, I cannot help coming and being like, oh, it sucks getting picked on, you know? Like,
right, right.
Right? Like, so were you a cool guy in high school? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Oh, no. I'm just saying, like, I guess I'm saying it, like, listen up.
Yeah.
Listen up, cool kids. Stay away from, like, don't make that person your target. I was saying it more like a warning. I feel that way, too. I think we've all, if you've been through high school, I would say probably what? Conservatively, 80% of us have had a moment of complete embarrassment, right? On some level, you know, at least.
Completely. There was a tiny clique of girls that picked on me for a little bit in high school because, like, they had tried to ban a girl and I became friends with the girl that they banned. So then they moved the anger over to me because they wanted the girl to be, like, socially banned from all society. And I dyed my hair red during that period and they would yell, period hair at me or period head in the hallways because I had red hair. And, like, I guess that would be my carry activation. But, then, yeah, you get older. Now we're all friends on Facebook. What are you going to do? Time goes on.
Never become friends with them.
If everybody doesn't die in prom, eventually you get older. But, like, yeah, I mean, everybody has to have had a feeling like this. And if you haven't, I think you're the weirdest one of all.
Well, I think that this conversation that you and I are having right now is where this movie kind of works. It's, like, on two levels. It is, like, this idea of, like, cynicism and empathy, right? Because, like, they're, and that's, I think, battling at the movie. And I think that that's probably the best thing that De Palma does here, which is you don't really like Carrie as an audience member, but you also empathize with Carrie. But it's also, like, unpacking what horror is. It feels very European to me, which I think probably is the biggest influence, right? Because 1975, 1974, like, what are the horror movies of that time?
Yeah, there was, like, The Exorcist, who had been kind of one of the first and only at that time to be like, what if what's scary to us isn't a giant haunted house with, like, Victorian people wandering around and Frankenstein and Dracula, but what if what scares us is something intruding on the normal world? That was, right. To me, that is what the horror films of the 70s are about. You know, it's not like horror is a thing that takes place over there.
Well, we're seeing that with Stepford Wives, too, right?
Yeah, it's that horror is a thing that takes place in your normal-looking suburbs and houses and high schools. I've been iffy on a lot of New Hollywood my entire life just because I was raised being very suspicious of all the 70s films because, you know, it's a lot of, like, dudes making, showing tits in the shower. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, like, it put me off. But what they did so well is that these are people who were raised watching the B movie horror flicks as kids and, like, the B science fiction books when the Westerns and all of that. But then the only other cool thing happening in movies when they were kids was coming out of Europe. So, you know, because all the Hollywood stuff is, like, musicals and Ben-Hur. So it's like,
right.
People like Brian De Palma and all of his friends who were doing better at the time, fusing European French aesthetic to the big popcorn movies that they loved as children. And, like, that's where this is coming from.
And I think, you know, looking back at, like, the early 70s, really up until, like, what you said, The Exorcist and Stepford Wives, every horror film, or, let's just say a majority of horror films, are based on insane people. Like, oh, it is Leatherface. It is, you know, a person with some kind of crazy costume, like a true beast, or, you know, like this, you know, the Freddy Krueger mold, the Jason Voorhees mold, not this could happen in your backyard. These are teenagers. And I think that that is why I feel like it feels like an after-school special, because it does feel like, oh, this is a teen movie. We're looking at teens. We're seeing them in a little bit more of an unfiltered way. It is the story of this could happen in your town. This is not different than your town. This is happening there, you know? And I think also playing with religion and kind of grappling with that is really interesting with this movie. You know, it's like it's things that could be happening behind closed doors right down the block.
Exactly. Which is actually the experience that Stephen King had. Like, he had to go over to the religious girl that I mentioned. He had to go over to her house once in high school for something and was like, oh, that's how she's getting raised. Now I understand more that why she's a weirdo in school. But and to me, like, what is scary about Carrie is that there are Carries at literally every school. You know, there's more than one Carrie at most schools. Sissy Spacek said when she was growing up in Texas, there was a Carrie at her school. I think it was a girl named Dorothy who was bullied by everybody because she was really poor. And Sissy tried to make a point of, like, befriending her. There are Carries everywhere, and everyone has a little Carrie in them. but the Carries don't have ways of asserting their power. You know, this Carrie at least is able to get her mom off her back a little bit, to get some control in her life because she has telekinetic powers that scare her mother. But the fact that there are Carries who can't do anything to help themselves anywhere, you know, that can't just speak to their mom. Oh, I want to hear that scene where she speaks to her mom and tells her that this is how it's going to be now.
He ended your father and carried him off.
He ran away, Mama.
The devil tempted him.
He ran away with a woman, Mama. Everybody knows that.
You must renounce this power. You must give it up. You must never use it.
I'm going, Mama. You can't stop me. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
And in that moment, the way that I love that Sissy plays that is that she's just quiet about it. You know, she's not screaming. It's not a loud scene. She's like, here's how it's going to be. And we understand what's even like for her character, because we have those little glimpses of her like straightening her hair, fixing her skirt before she sees her mother. This idea of trying to look right for her mother and finally just not even having the big scream and meltdown. Just like, this is what it's going to be like. And so many girls don't get to do this. And as I'm talking about it, I'm realizing, I think on some level, I've never even thought of Carrie as a horror film. I think I've only ever thought of it as a tragedy.
Well, you know, I think that this movie has more to do with tragic films. You know, like look at Vertigo or Psycho, you know, even a movie like Deliverance. Like these are those movies horror? I guess you could say Psycho is horror, but it isn't really. Like it's kind of, it's been turned into horror, but really it's like, that's a unsolved mystery. It's an odd, you know, it's about this boy and his mother at its core. I think it's more elevated than horror. And I think that,
oh, you saying that makes me realize then what in here you're picking up on that feels very A24 about it, right?
Yeah. I find it really interesting that Nancy Allen didn't realize that she was the villain or how she fit in the plot of it. Cause in her mind, she's like, oh, I'm just a dumb, like high school kid. I'm just like playing this thing with Travolta and we're just like these assholes. But again, to what you're saying, there's millions of Carries. There's also millions of Nancy Allens, people that might not even want to do this thing, but they're not even thinking it through. Like, oh, I don't, like, she's like, I don't even think I'm the villain. And then I saw it. I'm like, oh, of course. Like, we can't step out of ourselves. Like, I remember there
was... That's fascinating. Because you're right. That's like a larger scale of what we even see Irving's character does. That she's jumping in and throwing and screaming and yelling at her with tampons in the beginning. And then she's like, wait, what am I doing? That people are Nancy's and Sue's.
Right. She's catching herself. And I think that idea is why people revisit this. You know, why do we go back to this story? And I think if you can balance it on both sides and you can see yourself as the bully and as the bullied, then the movie actually works, because there might always be someone that you look down on, even if you are the person that's looked down upon, right?
Yeah, people do that to even make themselves feel better. Like, yeah. Even in here, there's like the English teacher who's played by that guy who's in Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
And he's like a dorky English teacher. But whenever Carrie pipes up and says that the poem is beautiful, he tries to turn on her to make himself look cooler, right? He's like, oh, if I pick on the bullied girl, then my students will think I'm cooler. And I love that, like, Tommy's like, you asshole, basically. But like, that's such a thing that the people, even George McFly, remember he did the same thing in Back to the Future when like his son shows up at the diner. He doesn't know it's his son and Biff is trying to bully Marty. He's like, yeah, bullying Marty too, just because he's like, this will save my life if I can align myself with the guys in charge.
And I think that, you know, maybe what's happening here too, and what is the big revolutionary device is, this is, like Scream, meta on some level. It is playing into all those tropes of the high school prom, the first kiss, and it's subverting it at the same time. So you are putting yourself in this package that's so familiar. It's heightened. And not only is it heightened, everyone's going to die. Now, I did have an issue that Carrie killed a lot of people that seemed to be very nice to her. I mean, PJ Souls, why is she one of the first people to get decapitated? The two older men at the prom, they seem pretty nice.
I mean, the principal did keep getting her name wrong.
I mean, yeah, I guess that's the truth.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great joke.
I mean, Betty Buckley, who plays the teacher, she had like the same issue. She's like, why do I die? I'm trying so hard to be nice to her. And the fact that Carrie kills her is what I think makes Carrie so awesome. It's so hardcore. Because it's like, oh, well, you know,
But then you have this thing at its center, which is, why is Carrie like this? And it's not like, oh, she's book smart or she's this. It's like she is being emotionally abused by her mother, like mommy dearest level, like and the power that religion can play in the mind of someone whose mind is being formed. I mean, yes, her mom, Piper Laurie, is over the fucking top. But also those scenes are like, I'm leaning in, I'm watching it, and everything that gets kind of brought together is in that closet, like that closet where there's the crucified Jesus, you know, it's like that, like, oh, and it becomes real. Like, I think that's what this movie does. It's like, it does some very heightened things. And then it also kind of gut punches you. Like, as you're laughing at it, it just punches in there. Now, I recognize that, you know, that closet because, you know, I have something very similar where I record this podcast and it's less religious iconography, but I do go in here when my wife is mad at me. but I don't know. I think that to me is the biggest moment of sympathy that I get for her. And I think that we don't get that until what, like maybe 20 or 30 minutes in. That's the first time I'm like, oh, Carrie is this way because her mom is so fucked up about this, the way that her mom believes. It's like, it's, we all know those people. Like the people, like, it's like, there's an energy, like she can't escape this. She can't be anything other than this. And she's trying a little bit, but she's scared.
The Carrie that we meet isn't just a little wimp. You know, Sissy of Spacek was like, I don't want her to just be a little wimp who cries all the time. You know, and part of why she got the job is when she did the audition, Brian De Palma realized that the girl that he was absolutely convinced was going to get the job, that he was like 1,000% sure was going to get the job, made Carrie seem like too much of a victim. But it's in those little glimpses where like Carrie is trying to stick up for herself. When her mom's like, your dress is red. And she's like, it's pink.
Red. I might have known it would be red.
It's pink, Mama.
That's when you see who Carrie could have been if she didn't have this mom. You see her, it's almost like a prison escape movie where you see the real Carrie fighting to try to get out of this shell that she's been put in. And to see her go to the prom and have this first glimpse of really who she could have been and then get it taken away, oh my God.
Because she's not super awkward. Like she is, there's humanity there. But I think this movie kind of plays with this time and time again. Like, I'm going to bet, and you'll be able to tell me if I'm right, like, this is the movie that creates, like, the denouement of horror, where it's like, oh, one more scare, right? This movie has the one more.
Oh, yeah. The fatal attraction. She's not dead. Yeah.
Right. And, but I think in that end, there is a thing like, oh, yeah, she belongs in hell. Like, she does belong in hell. She killed all those people, and like she's in with the devil, because it doesn't, like the for sale sign say like Carrie burn in hell and she comes out of the grave. Like, you don't think of it as, and in many respects, she's mad, right? And she doesn't, and the power that she wields, she doesn't have full control over it. But in that moment, she just attacks. And then we are against her again. Like, here's a girl that's been embarrassed. Like, if you get embarrassed, should you kill everybody in your class in school? Absolutely not. I understand that. But I think it plays with the audience's point of view. Like, is she a hell child? Does she deserve this? I don't know. I don't know if she's evil. Is she evil? But I think the movie is like, you think she's evil. You think she is burning in hell. Oh, just fooled you. Just a dream.
I mean, I hope she's not burning in hell. But I also, I can see that, like, part of why I find this movie so compelling is, messing with the audience's POV. Because, like, honestly, we in the audience are the only people who knows everything that's happening, because Carrie never has a chance anywhere in this movie to tell anybody what's going on with her. Like, nobody knows. Nobody's listening. Her mother is not listening when she's trying to talk to her. She doesn't feel comfortable talking to anybody at school. You know, Tommy's like, what are you reading? And she's reading books about telekinesis because she's got telekinesis. But she's like, sewing. You know, there's never a chance where Carrie gets to explain herself, and everybody dies except for Sue, right? So, like, all people in this town will ever know about Carrie is that some crazy girl went and murdered all of our children, and they'll never understand what was happening in her heart. And like, that is so sad for her. But at the same time, what we see of the prom is like Carrie being nervous this is a trick, being told that like maybe this is a trick, maybe he doesn't really want to take her to prom. Why is this guy taking her to prom? She knows he has a girlfriend. His girlfriend is in her gym class. What is happening? And then looking around this room and thinking the entire school set her up. Because when we see it through her point of view, she doesn't know that the entire school didn't set her up. She really believes that this might have been a giant school-wide prank, that Sue was in on it, that everybody was in on it, maybe even the teacher was in on it. You know, that moment when like they're all going to laugh at you and she's looking around the room and she sees all of these people laughing. What we're seeing in her head, and this is part of the craft I love of Brian De Palma, is she sees specifically Betty Buckley, the teacher, also laughing. And we know that's not true. We know right. that Betty Buckley is horrified and has been trying to stop it and is trying to protect her and is doing the wrong thing. Like Sue comes in trying to stop the bucket of blood from falling. And the teacher thinks that Sue is in on it too. The teacher never knows right. that Sue is trying to stop it. Nobody knows what anybody's trying to do, making it worse. And then Carrie is imagining they're all against her. And we can see that she is wrong. And that's part of the tragedy, right? That it didn't have to be this way, but nobody understands what anybody else is thinking.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hey, everybody. It's Rob Lowe here. If you haven't heard, I have a podcast that's called Literally with Rob Lowe. And basically, it's conversations I've had that really make you feel like you're pulling up a chair at an intimate dinner between myself and people that I admire, like Aaron Sorkin or Tiffany Haddish, Demi Moore, Chris Pratt, Michael J. Fox. There are new episodes out every Thursday. So subscribe, please, and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, and then I think this becomes a lot more complicated when you start to think about what's going on in American culture now, right? Because we are in a world of school shootings, mm-hmm. right? And that to me, you know, is one of the most atrocious things. It's, you know, there's so many things going on, but I think we often do the same thing that we're doing to Carrie. I don't want to equate the two, but I think it makes this movie more complicated. In a simpler time, this is an easier thing to look at. But at the same time, we're talking about something that is as culturally relevant as it's ever been, because there are kids who go out and attack.
Yeah. And adults too.
And adults too. Yes, you're right. Absolutely. And, you know, and so then, and one way we're like, well, then we have to give them their, like, what was their laughing at moment? What was their, and, you know, and that becomes a conversation I don't think many people want to have. And not that I even want to have it. I am like, it's hard. There's absolutism there because, you know, you think about this stuff and you talk about the legacy of Carrie in this town and how everyone will only know her as that. That's true for anything, you know, in that is, you know, that happens in school violence or happens, you know, where there any kind of tragedy happens. Like the town is on some level forever marred with that and a narrative.
Yeah.
Of that.
And you want to think that you can cut through all of it with a message of empathy, right? Like, what if we were just nice?
Right.
Like, what if you gave everybody a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt? What if you didn't pick on anybody? Like, what if nobody had to get revenge in the first place, I guess? But then part of the evil trick of this movie is like, the bad things happen because people are trying to give empathy and it's just not working. gig. Like, it's, the damage is already too done, you know? That Sue, there's a world where, like, maybe Sue's plan could have totally worked and Carrie could have gone to the prom for the first time and had a really lovely moment, you know, and felt beautiful. And maybe that could have worked. I don't see how, because I always think, like, even if Carrie didn't burn down the prom, what, is Sue not going to date her boyfriend anymore? Like, what? You know, like, I don't see how any of this ever works out for anybody. But, like, to me, the fact that this film never quite boils down to, like, here's some bad people and here's a really good person. It's like, here's a mass murderer and here's some people who, like, some of them were bad, some of them were trying their best, but also doing bad things. That's, like, the gut punch, right? Because there's, what lesson can you take out of it?
Yeah.
Like, Carrie is a person with no good choices. And the only thing she wants the whole film is somebody to comfort her. Like, help me, hug me, I'm scared, nobody's being nice to me. And she can never, ever, 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 ever get it. Even when she's, like, covered in blood and, like, her mom is going to hold her for a second and then just, like, straight up stab her in the back.
My father, what name? I can go down. I will be.
And that's awful, right? Because what do we walk away from this with? There's nothing Carrie could have really done. Maybe she could have done things slightly less bad, but honestly, there's nothing she could have done that was good.
Yeah. And I think also what I learn more and more every day that I'm alive is that, you know, you're always growing, you're always learning, or hopefully you are. And high school is the most malleable, where you can make a decision that might wreck your life, that is uneducated, uninformed, doesn't even carry the weight of the knowledge of what you're even doing. Like, you're just not prepared. It's right. And I think that there are these things, like, when you're 20, you think you know everything. And then when you get older, like, oh, I thought I knew everything. I didn't know everything. Like, you, like, life brings all this sort of stuff, but you also are raging inside. There's a hormonal imbalance. And this movie is about a hormonal shift, right? An awakening, if you will, like a birth of this, you know, new feeling and sensation. And it's like,
'cause it does feel from the storytelling that she doesn't even realize she has these powers until she gets her period, really.
Right.
It seems like new to her too.
And how do you, you know, how do you protect kids from doing what ultimately is natural? You know, what is something that is for them to do? And not to say that every kid acts out, but, you know, they're, I mean, look, we can go back and say, like, oh, that's why some kids cut themselves. That's why some kids, you know, become best-selling authors because they write a great book. Like, they're, like, everyone takes out their emotional trauma, their pain in very different ways. But there is an outlet, and some people have more outlets than others. And, you know, and her mom is abusive. So she goes to this, you know, there is this thing where I think in that moment, it feels like there's no way out. And, you know, it's a complicated, and this is what I do think, like, as much as I don't, like, love this movie, I love what it represents. I think it's really well done. I think that, honestly, to me, it's one of those films that has been aped so much. I don't know if I can appreciate what it is. I see it. I understand it. This conversation is interesting to me. It's not a movie that I revisit because I think there are better versions of it.
I'm just going to keep gasping in horror.
I know. Well, I also think, and look, but I also think that this movie sets the table. So it's an interesting argument. Like, do you know, who do you give flowers? Do you give the movie, you know, do you give De Palma flowers for saying maybe this is his best film, you know, or do you say he invented a new version of horror, and then people have, I think, successfully heightened that version of horror and continue to feed it.
We have had this conversation about other films in the past, and usually I have sided on the side of, like, yeah, it started the thing, but the other things were better that came out of it.
Yeah.
Carrie, I'm going to say, no, Carrie is kind of the best version of this thing. So I would like to give you the Carrie challenge, which is, now that you've gotten over it, you've lost your Carrie virginity.
Yes.
And I feel like there was a lot of emotion coming into that.
100%,
you know, Rod Stewart was over there on the other end saying, like, hey, baby, come over here, Paul. It's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. So there was a lot riding on your first watch of Carrie.
I feel it.
Give it a year. Watch it again. Sink into it a little bit that time. And I would like to see how you feel then.
Yes.
Because I can understand that this might be, like, especially film with this much buildup.
And I will also argue that, you know, maybe in this way, you are right that I might even side with the fact of putting this on the list over others, because I actually understand like how much of an effect it had. I also have to say, De Palma has a brilliant eye for casting. The casting here is amazing. And I think that you look across the board, all these people really popped for a very long time. Surprisingly, William Catt didn't pop, right? Like, I mean, Greatest American Hero, one of my favorite shows as a child, I love. But yeah, he never really, and I thought he was great in it. And he's got a great look, you know?
He does have a great look. And doesn't Chris, the bully Nancy Allen, look so much like Sydney Sweeney? You're just like, well, there's...
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
You're like, there's baby Sydney Sweeney. But also this being like John Travolta's very first movie role. And there's something in his relationship with Chris, you know, with Billy and Chris, who are dating, that really hit me harder than usual in this watch. You know, talking about how people are shaped and formed and why they act in the ways that they do and when they're teens and you don't know what's happening. I don't think it ever really sunk into me that Chris has been treated with such violence herself in this movie.
Mm.
You know, she's slapped by her teacher to start with, but then she's in this relationship with John Travolta that is an abusive relationship. They're in an awful relationship, right?
Yeah.
They're always just yelling at each other, insulting each other. There's never any niceness. And he hits her twice. Pretty much every scene they're together, he hits her. He has a good chance of hitting her. And like, she's not going through the world thinking it's a nice and safe place either, right? She's beautiful,
yeah, no.
And she's mean, and she's got a lot of attitude, and she's like headstrong, and the world is not showing her gentleness.
Hurt people hurt people.
Hurt people hurt people, right? But it's there. And so, you know, and when you, and I think that Brian De Palma is trying to actually show us that, because we get these like parallel scenes of Sue and her boyfriend and Chris and her boyfriend, and they're both trying to get something out of them. You know, Sue is trying to get her boyfriend to agree to take Carrie to prom, even though he doesn't want to. And her way of doing it is like they're doing homework together. He's watching TV and she's giving him the silent treatment until he agrees to take Carrie to prom. And Chris's way of getting John Travolta to do it is to yell at him and then give him a blowjob.
Right.
So we know from this that they are in very different relationships where they are learning very different ways of how they're supposed to move through the world.
And I also love that De Palma brings back this couple in a way with Blowout. Right. I mean, you bring, you know, you kind of, there is something interesting about them. Like you can't take your eyes off of them. They're very unique in their douchebaggery. Right. Like they're not like they are like heightened assholes, but there is like a chemistry that I think arguably like Carrie, I don't know if I dislike her or like her, like, you know, but it's nothing so black and white. I'm into it.
I mean, let's be honest. If we were back in 1976 for a day at this high school and it was like, do you want to hang out with Carrie or do you want to hang out with Chris? You're probably going to want to hang out with Chris, right?
Oh, 1,000,000%.
I mean, they're like driving around, drink beer, hanging out. Like John Travolta is like, he looks like so cool, but also a doofus. He's like, the fact that he's like chugging beer, doing like the like, you know, American, they're doing the American graffiti, driving up down the street. He's drinking the beer and you're like, oh, that guy's cool. But then the cops show up and he has to drop the beer. And then he has like slobbery beer all over his face. He takes away just a little bit of his coolness. Like that's the craft.
I agree. Yeah. And I think that, you know, this is the thing that you are wrestling with. It is highlighting, it's giving you what you know, it's making fun of it, but at the same time also making you go, oh, but I kind of like them too. I don't know. You know, it's hard, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and they brutally die. And also, do you think that like Larry the Cable Guy totally stole his catchphrase from John Travolta?
Get her done. You can't do it from standing out here. Get her done, man. Get her done.
I can't.
Yes, Amy. I'm going to say yes to that.
Oh, but gosh, I mean, because when I start talking about like De Palma in his craft, I like really get excited. And oh my gosh, I mean, I think like of all of his camera techniques that he uses to tell this story, like the deep focus shots of like Tommy in the foreground and Carrie behind him in the classroom as she's saying that his poem is beautiful, or like the split screen so that when Carrie is using her telekinesis, we know what she's looking at as she activates it. Or to me, the most romantic one that just like catches me up every time is when Tommy and Carrie are at the prom and they're bonding for the first time. And they're having this like conversation where he's like really starting to see her as a human being. and they're spinning and the camera is just getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And you're Carrie and you're just getting caught up in this moment. Oh my goodness. That is how you use a camera. Oh gosh, Paul. And now I'm just like ranting because I love this movie so much. But like even when they pull up at the prom and Carrie is sitting in the car in the passenger seat and she waits a little beat for him to get around and open the car door. In those moments, you see that Carrie knows what she wants, actually. She's right. Not some lame pushover. She really wants to be treated in a way that she's never gotten to be treated. And I love that Tommy steps up to the plate. I think he's a nice, polite guy.
Well, and I think that, like, this is, again, don't judge a book by its cover, right? He would never want to be with her. Oh, gross. But maybe he does. Like, maybe he does. And that's what I like about this movie. It constantly is subverting expectations. I'm enjoying this conversation way more than I enjoyed the actual watching of the film, and that's okay.
Well, when you watch it again, you can tell me what you think.
Okay, I will. I like this challenge of a year later. I think that I'm really trying to put myself in a movie theater in 1976, and I think I would have walked out being like, whoa, right? It really, I think this movie would have gotten me then. And I can't believe that, you know, when you look at the old posters for it, they led with the pig's blood. And by the way, Sissy Spacek also led with the pig's blood because she kept that shit on her while they shot that whole stuff. Like, not just that day, for multiple days. She refused to kind of wash it off. So it became this like sticky, gooey thing. And she had somebody following her around with a spray bottle to not, you know, to get her chin unstuck from her chest. But she wanted to kind of have this on her body. Her eyes and that, like the way she looks. And again, that fetus is such a great, you know, description of her.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And isn't it wild to think that she's a 26-year-old married woman making this movie?
I mean, wild.
You just, like, what are you talking about? You know, and I love that
she looks out of time. She really does look out of time. Why was she hard to cast? Or not hard to cast, but why was she not the first choice? I know we teased that a little.
Yeah, I mean, I think De Palma, he had this actress in mind, and he's always been trying pretty vague about saying her name, but if you do some Googling, you can kind of figure it out. But she was like a little bit more of like a conventionally successful actress at the point. Like, she had just done a movie where a couple years ago where she played like a teenage girl who had to get an abortion. So he was like, that's definitely okay. My girl. She's going to be the big thing. And Sissy's whole story was, you know, her story is kind of fascinating, actually. She wanted to be a musician. This was her first goal. You know, she's from Texas, a real small town in Texas. I love hearing interviews with her where I'm reminded she's from Texas. She sounds so Texan. But she wanted to be like a folk music star. And she only had one single. But her music career never took off. So she moves to New York. She starts studying acting. And she finally lands a good role, which is Badlands, which is amazing. And maybe we should watch Badlands if you haven't seen Badlands, like the Terrence Malick movie. So great. But she meets her husband on that, who's Jack Fisk. He's like the production designer. And so they get married in this like crazy hippie wedding where like they're both wearing jeans. And the witness, I swear to God, was a dog. The dog signed their marriage papers with a paw print. I don't know how that's legal.
That's like that dog mayor. There's a dog mayor somewhere.
Like, yeah, they're in Idlewild. Yeah, the dog did it. And she wore her like wedding ring on her middle finger because she's just like, I'm a rock and roll kid. But because her husband was a production designer and they were really broke and they couldn't get a lot of work together, he was working on Brian De Palma films like Phantom of the Paradise, the movie he did before this, which is so good. Yes. And they just played it at Vidiot's. And so she was on the set of that, helping her husband out. But yeah, because of that, she's the girl who's hanging around a Brian De Palma set being the production designer's wife, right? And that's not a person you would imagine a director really takes seriously.
I mean, we have talked about a director who takes the production designer seriously, right? Or no, I guess not the wife. I was thinking Polly Platt.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
But I guess that's the production designer. Yeah. So that's a little bit different.
And then I guess there are people milling around these sets. Like, I think one of the people who helped decorate the prom here was Bill Paxton, who eventually does get taken more seriously. But yeah, so like he just didn't think that she was really the right person for the part because she was like, that's Sissy. She's, you know, Jack's wife. And Jack actually does the production design here, which I think is lovely that he's the person kneeling at her feet in the shower scene, putting the blood in her hand. He's the person dumping the blood on her at the end. Like, the lovely trust of being the person who gets to cover your wife in blood, I think, is very, very romantic. But also Sissy just has, I think, a very distinctive look that nobody knows what to do with, really. You know? I mean, she's perfect for Carrie because of that kind of strange look. And I'm trying to be very kind talking about her look because Sissy is one of the only two people in my life I ever get told I look like, even though I don't quite understand it.
I get it.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But different.
Okay.
But no, but I think it's, I think that's a compliment.
I take it as a compliment. I think it's because we're blonde people who don't wear mascara. I mean, I think that's what it boils down to. Her, me, and I have bangs. That's why I get Joni Mitchell. But
yes.
Yeah. Even after Sissy does Carrie, she gets nominated for Best Actress for the Oscars. She still can't find a good job for 2 years. And she even goes down to the unemployment office in LA. And she's like, I'm waiting for good parts. I can't get good parts. Nobody gives me good parts.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is wild.
Well, we talked about this again to revisit what we talked about in the past, that idea of The Exorcist, right? You get so synonymous with something in horror that I think a lot of times as women, they're not able to get back.
Yeah, that's really
true. Get in, you know, we've seen it time and time again.
It super happens. And the way that she finally convinced De Palma here was, you know, she made it to the final three finally. He was letting her audition, but he kept having her audition for Chris for some reason. And she was like, all right, I can be Chris. And then he tells her at the end, he doesn't think she's sexy enough to be Chris. So she was like, okay, well, I wanted to be Carrie the whole time anyway. And he's like, ugh. And so it comes down to the final three where they're going to do a screen test. And he's like, the day of the screen test, she actually has a job doing a commercial for a headache medicine called Vanquish.
Okay.
And so she tells Brian De Palma, I really want to be Carrie, but I also have this job that day. And he's like, do the commercial, take the job because you're not getting Carrie. It's going to be this other girl.
Oh my God.
It made her so mad that she did not take the headache commercial job. And she rubbed all this Vaseline in her hair to look really gross. And she pulled out this blue sailor dress that her mom had made her in seventh grade.
Whoa.
And she reread the entire book. And she was like, fuck you. I'm getting this part. I will show him. She was like, I went into that audition feeling unwanted, feeling angry. In that she just cut through all the noise. And so when the other girl does it too victimish, it's her anger, I think, made her get that role. And in a tiny Easter egg, when Carrie's walking home, and that kid is like, creepy Carrie, creepy Carrie.
Creepy Carrie, creepy Carrie!
The dress she's wearing is actually the dress she wore to the audition. That's the blue sailor suit dress that her mom had made her.
And I believe that kid is related to Brian De Palma,
oh,
right?
Oh, really? Oh, I love how that kid falls and we get to laugh in his face about it.
Okay, so interesting thing about that creepy Carrie, the kid in the movie, that is actually De Palma's nephew, but didn't like his performance. So he brought in, our friendly, lovely school teacher to do his family's own line. And that is the voice of the teacher playing multiple parts there. So there you go. Little inside scoop.
Oh, I love that so much. But now you can't imagine anybody but Sissy Spacek in this role, right?
There's no one else. Yeah, that she does so much with her damn face that, that actually I think, I can't even understand what other people could do because I feel like she pulls you in. She pulls you in.
Yeah, she's like that. She's got that open face that feels sort of vulnerable and just sort of alien at the same time, she's ridiculous. She actually, in this kind of tour of the success right after Carrie, she got to do an episode of Saturday Night Live where she was the host. And her whole thing, she gave a whole kind of sweet lecture. You can hear her, Southern accent come out, but she pretends she's going to show them a deleted scene from Carrie.
Oh, and before I forget, I want to say to the Academy members, not to influence your vote or anything, but when the ballots go out on Monday, just remember, my best scene was cut from Carrie. And I'd like to, if I can, recreate that scene for you now to give you more of an idea of my full talent. It's the day after the prom. Most of the kids aren't around anymore. I'm alone on a field, a football field. It's the day of the big game. And I've elected myself. Oops. Baton Queen.
The majorette that she's doing is really the closest to real Spacey, but oh my gosh, she just pulls this off. And while we're just briefly really talking about actresses holding out for the parts that are right for them and not getting work, we have to say that, like, Piper Laurie being in this movie is fascinating. Piper Laurie just passed away this year. But Piper Laurie had been one of those, like, studio starlets, you know, of, like, the 50s. But she wanted to be taken seriously as an actress and not be, like, a starlet. So she finally did a movie that maybe someday we'll do. She did The Hustler with Paul Newman. It's the movie that's, like, the prequel.
Movie, yeah.
Right. Yeah, she's the girl in that. It's the prequel to The Color of Money. She gets an Oscar nom. That's 1961. And she stops making movies for 15 years and doesn't come back until Carrie. 15 years. And then she gets another Oscar nomination, which that's what?
That's what? Kind of like the the Joe Pesci model, right? Like, just doesn't work that much, then works, kind of hits it out of the park, then goes home again. It's an interesting thing.
It really is. And, you know, it's like a lot of her loud scenes in this movie are kind of the ones that get all the attention, you know, of course, because it's funny. And she, like, said at the time on the set, she just thought this movie was preposterous, that she was having a really funny time laughing about it. But one of the scenes she has that freaks me out the most is, like, the first time we see her, when Margaret is going door to door talking to the other moms in the neighborhood. And you get to, it's your only glimpse of what the mother is like to other people. You know, the false front that she puts on when she talks to other people. The fact that maybe nobody knows how bad Carrie's home life is because they know that her mom's really weird, but her mom is acting nice and polite.
Oh, Mrs. White.
How have you been, Mrs. Smith?
Fine.
And the doctor?
Fine.
And your daughter?
Sue is fine. Won't you come in, Mrs. White?
Oh, how kind of you.
When I see that scene, all I see is a woman trying to do, like, an impersonation of Scarlett O'Hara to be charming. How formal and sweet she is. Oh, yes, blah, blah, blah. And isn't that scary that this mother just has the range of controlling who she's going to present to people?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that performance is really, I mean, again, it's, that's like the A24 of it all. Like, that reminds me of, like, Hereditary and these scenes that you see that are so unnerving because they truly are these people that are out of their mind, but they are trying to hold it together. And that, to me, is such a great, I can watch.
Yeah. And it was like Piper's idea that when she dies in the end, which is a much bigger death than the one in the book, that she would play the scene of getting stabbed, you know, by, like, as though she was having an orgasm, as though she was, like, having her death throw ecstatic orgasm, and death is all she ever really wanted was to, like, go and be in the arms of Jesus, which is so creepy. Her smile.
Oh, my God.
Whoa. I mean, that was her pitch to De Palma, and he totally went with it, which, amazing.
Well, Amy, I think that we really unpacked Carrie, this little novella. There's so much more here. And I think I am siding with you that maybe this is the movie that goes on the list because for whatever reason, I get that it had such an impact on this field of horror genre, I should say. So, you know, we'll see. In a year, I'll revisit it. We'll make a mental note and I'll come back and check.
I want you to revisit it in a year.
Okay.
Revisit in a year. Really sink into it.
Okay.
To me, the only mistake the entire movie ever makes is, like, for some reason, Brian De Palma at one point is like, I've been having a lot of fun with weird camera tricks. What if I make the guys at the prom shop talk really fast for absolutely no reason?
That was so bizarre. Yeah. I didn't even mention that because I thought that something happened to my iTunes. I was like, oh, shit. Okay. Whatever.
No, just absolutely. He was like, I think the scene is taking too long. What?
Oh, my gosh. You know, Amy, talking about these influences in this film and in the score, we've talked about it a few times here, but it reminds me of our conversation about Psycho and really what that did to horror. Another movie that really, again, is it a horror? I don't know. But a movie that really changed up the type of movies that we are going to start to see.
I love that. Okay, Paul. Well, next week we are going to do a movie that I think I was too old for the first time I saw it. And I feel like I have been completely out of lockstep with the culture because I don't get why this movie is good. And I think you love it. We're going to do Goonies.
Oh, you know I love it, and I'm so excited to talk about it. You gotta get on the Goonies bandwagon. And maybe we'll have a reverse of this conversation. I don't think it's as deep, but you know, look, sleeping pirates lie. Maybe that's the connective tissue. Anyway, Goonies is available wherever you stream your films. Just come over to my house. I'll let you borrow my copy. I have it on all formats. Anyway, Amy, what a pleasure. Make sure you check out our store at tpublic.com and pick up a pack of cards. And you know what? My book is coming out. It's coming out very shortly. Joyful Recollections of Trauma, wherever you get your books, your audiobooks or your e-books. And I'm going to be on tour in New York and Chicago. Just go to my website or Unspooled and you can see all the places I'm at. And I would love to see you out there.
We can see a video you took of you announcing where you're going to be in a cold plunge tub.
Yes, in a 33 degree cold plunge tub. I did that for you. We'll see you next week. Our show could not be done without our team, and a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford, and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy, and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media, and you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram, and you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section. T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled. And you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
Find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.